Hey everybody, welcome to the Limitless Grid podcast. In today's episode, we have Steve Huynh. Steve was a principal engineer at Amazon and runs a very successful YouTube channel called An Engineered Life, where he teaches people how to grow in their careers. Steve, thank you for taking the time to talk with us. The last time we spoke a couple of weeks ago, you know, you dropped in a lot of nuggets of gold and I wish we had recorded that conversation, but I'm glad, you know, we are here again. Thanks for your time.
I will try to drop some more nuggets during this conversation.
Awesome. So you have a very popular YouTube channel that helps engineers who want to grow in their career. And I'm just like fascinated with that channel. I've watched every single video and I wanted to ask, like, when did you decide to start that channel? And like, what was the thought process behind starting that channel?
Oh, that's a great question. Thank you for being such a big fan. The genesis of the channel came from the pandemic. I work in live sports broadcasting at Amazon, and during the pandemic, all live sports stopped, and we were all holed up in our respective houses and trying to figure out what was going to happen next, you know, whether we were going to get sick, if the people that we knew and cared about were going to get sick or not. And I think the difficult bit was for the first time in my life, I had a ton of extra time. And so I was watching a ton of YouTube channels. And, you know, I think the genesis for my channel, to be quite honest, came from maybe a negative place. There is another YouTuber. He's really quite popular. He's maybe not as positive as I'd like to be. And so I thought to myself, like, why couldn't there be a positive version of the type of content that he created? He created content for software engineers.
I think we know who the YouTuber you're talking about.
I think so.
And, you know, I'm you guys are getting to know me a little bit. You know, I think I'm a pretty positive person. And so I don't really like to put down others. So, but yeah, that's where it really came from. Was, you know, like, why not create some content that I would have appreciated when I was a younger person coming up in the industry? And so, you know, I just threw myself into it. And I'm into photography, but I didn't know the first thing about video production. And I just sort of figured it out. You know, live sports did start to come back. And so I did have a bunch of things to do at work. And so after about 5 videos, I stopped. And I thought that that was sort of the end of my YouTube career. But for some odd reason, the last video that I created sort of in mid-21 took off. And there was a lot of interest and a lot of views from the videos that I had created prior to that. You know, that sort of gave me some food for thought. In 22, I decided to just really go all in on the YouTube channel. I needed to rebrand my channel. I had named my channel Meta. And so Facebook had sort of stolen my name. But, you know, if you know anything about me, if I sort of commit to something, I just kind of go all in. So in 22, I decided to go all in on it. And yeah, I think the rest is history.
So I was watching your first 5 videos and they are really good. And the editing and everything looks really good as well. So when you decided to, you know, create those videos, like, were you editing yourself, or how did you go about, you know, having an idea that, hey, there are not many tech leads out there who are giving the positive message or being the mentor that, you know, I want them to be, to like creating content and, you know, putting it on YouTube? Like, what was that process?
Yeah, I had an idea in my mind about what I wanted for those videos. The problem was that my taste and my ability to create the videos, there was a very large gap there. At this point as well, like, I don't still think that they're quite there yet, but it's getting closer. I did have a pretty strong idea in my head of what I wanted to do, especially for those early videos, but I just didn't have the skills. And so it is kind of embarrassing to say, but that first video of mine that's, I think, under 4 minutes, that took me something on the order of like 100 hours to create, soup to nuts, from trying to figure
hours?
Out. Yeah, like camera settings and buying equipment and researching equipment and then writing the script and then doing a million takes. And then I think the bulk of that, the time as well, was just learning how to edit videos. I had no idea how to do it. And so, yeah, it took me so long. And, you know, if you want to torture a YouTuber, you know, sit them down and force them to watch their first video. I don't think I could do it, to be quite honest with you. And no, but, you know, the next video didn't take quite as long and the subsequent videos didn't take longer from there. But I did have a clear idea in my mind of what I wanted to say. One thing that, you know, you may not know about me is I have a degree in creative writing. I do have a minor in math and applied math. And so, you know, I parlayed those skills to become a software engineer. But really what I wanted to do in college was to sort of create, in this case, it was write, short stories and poetry and other forms of expository writing. But I decided that I wanted to make money. That's a really tough life to become a writer. And so, you know, I think there was a lot of creativity, especially in those early videos that I, you know, that was actually a lot of fun and sort of made that 100 hours or so of work kind of fly by.
In that 100 hours, like how many hours did you spend to write that script? Because I feel like you have like 135K followers and only like 36 videos. So there is a reason why people gravitate towards your content. And I think it's because it's so concise and it's full of value. And I think the way you organize your content is really incredible as well. So I wanted to ask, like, what's your creative process and like how long does it take you to write a script for your YouTube videos?
Yeah, I appreciate the compliments. I have since outsourced the editing. I've outsourced it to a couple of different editors. It's a constant battle to find somebody that will be able to do that to you at the quality that you'd like. What I've discovered and the mental model that I have is essentially when you create a YouTube channel, you are doing a startup and you're doing all of these jobs. You know, you're a pre-production script writer, you are the video producer, you're the editor, packager, marketer, all of this stuff put into one, making thumbnails. And for every creator that's out there, you sort of have to determine like, where are the places where you're adding differentiation, where your effort is differentiated? And then where is the effort sort of not differentiated? There are a bunch of YouTubers out there where the dimension of their creativity is through the editing process. And so if you actually took away that editing process from them, their content would suffer and they wouldn't be able to express themselves to the fullest extent. For me, it's not editing. I'm an okay editor and I take like way too long. And so I made the realization that I'm not adding a bunch of differentiated effort on that front. The place where I think I do add a ton is in the script writing process. And so, you know, if you outsourced the script writing from my channel, I think my channel sort of falls apart, right? And so that's the one thing that I can't outsource. And that's specific to me and my content. I have a lot of pithy writing sayings, but, you know, if writing is actually not a problem. It doesn't take any time at all if you have something to say, right? If there's a clear, like if you have some amount of clarity about what you want to say and some idea about, you know, the structure of what you'd like to say, I find that I can sit down and knock out a script, you know, within an hour or two if I've been sort of like chewing on an idea for some amount of time. Now, if I sit down in front of a blank page and I don't have anything to say, right? I'm trying to synthesize an idea or, you know, the ideas that I have are, you know, maybe not as clear in my head, or I kind of have themes, but I don't really have a point. That can take an indefinite amount of time to write. And so, you know, before I quit my job, my production schedule was basically wait around until some idea hit me in the face. And then the script writing process would just sort of, you know, it would just sort of unfold. And then I would be able to quickly, you know, turn on the camera, you know, get some footage and then throw it over to my editor. Now that I've quit my job, you know, I think I want to push myself and get myself on a little bit more of a schedule. I also think that I want to go bigger. And, you know, so I've been kicking around the idea of maybe doing even longer form content, like a documentary. And, you know, these types of projects just weren't open to me before I decided to leave my job.
So you were like an L7 engineer and you were at Amazon for 18 years, right? And a lot of people don't try to put themselves out there on YouTube or in social media because they have this identity about themselves and like people perceive them a certain way. And like, were you scared to put yourself out there? And also, like, at what point did you feel comfortable telling your coworkers, hey, I have video on YouTube and, you know, I'm creating content?
I think it's a universal feeling of being really, really scared, nervous, and anxious when you hit that publish button. It doesn't matter if you have zero subscribers or a million subscribers. The thing that I learned from Ali Abdaal, so I took his YouTube course and I had a conversation with him, or at least was able to ask him.
Was that the course before your first five videos or after your first five videos?
It was after. It was after. Okay. Yeah. He put it really succinctly, which is basically, nobody cares that you do YouTube. Especially when you start. That's really true. I hit the publish button and I was just sort of waiting for my videos to sort of skyrocket, and they didn't get any views for many weeks. And I published my second one and they didn't get very many views at all. And the really weird thing is if you let your relatives or your friends know that you have a YouTube channel, they will immediately ask, oh, what's it about? And then they will essentially like not listen to what you said and then change the subject immediately thereafter. It's universal. Nobody cares that you have a YouTube channel. And, well, they will care eventually, right? If you end up getting big, you know, they will bring it up. You know, I get stopped a lot on campus at Amazon. Right. People are like, hey, you know, do you make those YouTube channels? I actually try to make it a rule that I never bring it up in conversation. The conversation comes to me, you know, when I'm sort of walking around or when they're asking for a selfie or whatever. But,
you're like an Amazon celebrity then.
that is an oxymoron if I ever heard one. But yeah, it's I think that. It's a nice place to be when you don't have to tell people like how important you are or whatever. It's just you can let the content speak for itself. And if it helps people, you know, that's the validation that I don't need, but you know, really makes my day.
Hmm. Yeah. Since we spoke about Amazon and your software engineering journey, now we want to dive deeper into it. And So you worked as an L7, you know, before you left Amazon, and you worked there for 18 years. Amazon is also known to be one of the most brutally competitive places to work for. So how did you not only survive, but thrive over there?
I think there's some amount of Stockholm syndrome associated with working there. Stockholm syndrome's where, you know, you're in a sort of like kidnapping situation. At some point, the captured starts to feel very comfortable around the cap doors. I really love some things about Amazon and I really dislike some things about Amazon. The things that I love are that the company is truly customer obsessed. You can literally stop a meeting in its tracks by saying, hey, that's not a very customer obsessed thing to do. It'll be like a needle coming off a record and everybody will just stop and then we'll try to inspect whether that statement is true or not. And, you know, and a lot of other companies, they're maximizing for top line revenue, bottom line revenue, market share. I think those are good temporary targets and waypoints. But I think that type of value statement is not durable. It doesn't represent a North Star. I think that if you want to describe Amazon, the thousands of businesses and sub-businesses that are contained within that broad corporation, you could summarize it in four words. Amazon is Earth's, how do I put it? It's Earth's most customer-centric company. Customers are our magnetic north. And so that really resonates with me. And it really makes everything make sense. And so if you're in a situation where like a lot is asked of you and a lot is expected, but you don't understand why, you can't sort of like ask the why questions and then eventually get to an answer that is satisfying, I think that it makes your work very, very difficult. I think that when there is clarity of purpose, that really, I think, sort of papers over a lot of the things that maybe I didn't like so much about the company. But, you know, I think Amazon is often characterized as evil and overworking people. I don't really see it that way. I see it as this singular focus, this absolute fever of trying to help customers as much as they can. And sometimes, you know, that leads to actions that from the outside don't look so good. But, you know, I think internally make a ton of sense. The other thing I'll say is there are very, you know, big tech sort of gets put down quite a bit. Because, you know, they're so large and they're a very easy target. But you can actually do a bunch of really cool things within the confines of a corporation with the resources that Amazon has. And so, you know, I worked on the first Kindle. That was one of the first projects that I worked on when I joined the company. I worked on the precursor to Prime Video. So I helped launch Prime Video. I worked in payments. And so I saw, you know, the software that I wrote, you know, transacted billions of dollars. And it was a relatively small feature. I understand how search works. I understand how e-commerce works at Amazon scale. I understand, you know, there were a couple of businesses that I worked on that failed, but I understand deeply how those work. And so these are the sort of things that you don't have access to if you work at a startup, if you start your own company, or you don't have access to if you work at a medium-sized non-tech company. And so if you're fascinated about how things actually work, how do you deliver, you know, low latency, live video streaming to 200 countries, right? At a high quality and high availability, like you don't have access to that type of knowledge unless you work within, you know, one of these large tech giants.
Totally. How many teams did you work for?
It depends on how you count it. Sometimes you'll work within a large organization and there's a reorg. I have counted how many managers I've had. And so I've had over 20 managers.
Oh, wow. 20 managers.
Yes. And the last 5 years, I've reported to the same person. So for like 13 years, I had over 20 managers.
Say if somebody is a new manager, what advice would you give them so that they can help their subordinates grow in their career as well?
Absolutely. So I'll preface this by saying that I've never been a manager. What I would say is that the best managers play a support role. They are supporting their direct reports so that their direct reports can do wonderful things. In the case of Amazon, so that the direct reports can obsess over customers and deliver value to customers. I think the worst type of managers think about the hierarchy and the power dynamics, and they're thinking about managing their teams in terms of being like a general in a war where there's like a strict chain of command and they're calling the shots. I think that ultimately what you want to do is you want to hire a bunch of high functioning, high performing individuals that are hell-bent on doing the right thing for customers and making sure that you support them. So that support may involve, you know, providing air cover for randomized requests. It may involve, you know, giving them enough context so that they can make localized decisions. It may involve, you know, coming up with like performance plans and growth plans for all of their direct reports. But not a lot of those things are this sort of like command and control, like orders coming from the top down.
Yeah, there's like less of a dictatorship as opposed to like a two-way highway.
Absolutely. Now, there are definitely situations where manager needs to make a call and a decision and then maybe change direction and sort of like order that. But I think that it is, you know, if you want to talk about the 80-20 rule, I think 80% should be in a support role managing down. And, you know, the other 20% is, I guess, managing up and then, you know, sort of like leveraging their authority.
So you mentioned that you were also a bar raiser in one of your videos. So you mentioned that you were a bar raiser at Amazon. And how many interviews have you taken at Amazon?
I've taken over 850 interviews.
815. Yeah. I mean, there is so much of content available online, you know, on the interview prep, especially for the tech companies. And it's very hard to kind of sort, you know, what is garbage and what is not. So from your experience, Steve, what do you think is the most common mistake that people make, you know, while in both preparing and interviewing at these tech companies?
I think, you know, the failure modes that I've seen the most are thinking that the interview is a sort of like binary test, right? So that you pass the test, then you can get an offer. In a sense, that's true. Really, the underlying premise behind interviews, at least at Amazon, is trying to get a sense of whether like you would be a good team member, right? Whether we would like to work with you or not. It's not about you performing well within the confines of the interview, right? And so what we're trying to do is we're trying to see, like, can this person code? Can this person design a system? Great. I think of those functional competencies as the ante. So those must be true. If we're hiring you as a software developer, you need to have software developer skills, as an example. But the part where we're trying to figure out whether we want to work with you or not is in the behavioral interview. And so Amazon, at least, indexes quite a bit on behavioral questions. And so those are things like, those questions are really trying to determine whether there's like a shared set of values, right? Or whether you would do well within an Amazonian environment. So for instance, are you a difficult person to work with or not? So I might ask you a question about, you know, tell me about a time when you had to deal with a difficult coworker. There's an underlying question there, which is, are you the difficult coworker, right? And so we're kind of probing on prior experience, unlike investments, right? So, you know, future returns are not guaranteed based off of prior performance. Unlike investments, I think that behavioral questions, we index on priors quite a bit. And so, you know, your ability to package your experience and effectively communicate it to your potential employer, I think is really, really important. And a situation where a lot of candidates, they tend not to index on that very much. They tend to index on leet code preparation, right? So the coding interview. They tend to over-index on the system design. Again, those things are very important. But the real, like, answering that question of, like, does this company want to work with you or not? I think people tend to gloss over that a little bit too often.
It's also extremely overwhelming because lead code in itself is an ocean. And then systems design on top of that is another ocean. And by the time you even get to the point of like behavioral question, you don't put as much time in that bucket. So I think, you know, as a result, like a lot of people might not pass a coding interview.
Yeah, and that's certainly a risk, right? You don't want to spend all of your time talking about your experience, but then you don't spend any of your preparation on the coding part, and you essentially you don't ante up, right? What I would say though is a lot of the coding interview preparation has been democratized, right? And so there is so much content out there on getting prepped for the coding interview. When I was getting into the industry, there was no concept of like leet code or neat code or typing in code into a browser to see if you actually answered this stuff, we literally coded things on whiteboards. And now, even though it is a large amount of stuff to prepare for, there are these problem sets, you know, the Grind 75, the Blind 75, the NECODE 150, all of these things, where they've sort of condensed down all of the questions that different companies ask. And if you can conquer 75 questions, which I think is within, you know, most software developers' grasps, you don't have to spend any more time, right? There's a diminishing return there. And so while it is a very large space, it's still bounded. Similarly, with system design, it's been democratized quite a bit. You know, Alex Hsu's book on the cracking the system design interview, volume 1 and 2. There was no such resource like that when I was interviewing, and now there are so many resources that are out there. Now, system design is a little bit more unbounded than the coding interview, but the information is out there, right? And so if you get systematic, if you get, you know, if you really sort of use your time effectively, I do think that most software developers, if they're really stick at it, like, they can get it, right? All of that stuff is, you just have to put in the reps and the time, right? The behavioral stuff, that's the stuff where, you know, if you neglect it, that's at your own peril.
So, you know, like, this comes down to, like, being productive with your time and understanding how to manage your time. And I feel like you are a master at it, because you are an L7 engineer. Like, you had a YouTube channel, a successful YouTube channel. On top of that, you have kids and extremely, like, productive in every sense. So for someone, like, who is overwhelmed right now and, like, want to implement some systems in their life to be more productive, like, what advice would you give?
So sometimes I describe myself as a productivity junkie. You know, if there's a book on productivity or time management, you know, it's probably in my Kindle library or in my Audible library. What I have found for myself, just in general, is that there's no silver bullets there. Your body, for some reason, and your mind are very good at adaptation. And they're trying to optimize for minimizing energy usage, right? And so once you adapt to one style of time management or productivity, it's like your brain sabotages itself. And it's like, oh, that's not going to work anymore. It's sort of like the Borg. I don't know if you watch Star Trek at all. But, you know, if you use a weapon against them, it's going to work the first time, but then they will adapt, and then that weapon no longer is useful. And so what I have found is that I tend to cycle through different approaches in a way that sort of keeps my brain guessing. Right. And it doesn't give enough time for my brain to adapt. And so I cycle through things like getting things done, bullet journaling, Cal Newport's deep work.
Getting things done?
Yeah, there's a getting things done, GTD or whatever. And so there's all these different sort of frameworks that are out there. The one that I've been using recently has been relatively durable, but that's it's some sort of hybrid for a Cal Newport system. Essentially, I do a quarterly plan, so I try to target, you know, 3 to 5 big themes that I'd like to accomplish within the next quarter, right? So it might be getting my course up and running, right? Or starting a newsletter, or getting back into shape, right? And sort of like restarting my fitness routines. And then what I'll do is, on a weekly basis, I will try to chip away at that larger goal, right? And so I'm a really big fan of sustained, like, and slowly working away at a problem. So consistency over intensity, right? And so as long as I can make a little bit of progress every day or every week against that goal, that's the sort of secret for head turning achievement. Are the things that you can't achieve by staying up all night or working over the weekend. It's only the stuff that where you have to do some amount of work over a sustained period of time that I think is really impressive, right? And then so I'll have the 3 to 5. Sometimes that list balloons up a little bit because of like smaller details, but I try to keep that list of things that I'm going to target for the week relatively small. You know, so for the past year and a half, that's been my system.
Actually, Steve, I want to circle back to the interview section that we spoke a little bit about. You know, you mentioned that the company is trying to figure out, like, are you the annoying coworker or not? But, you know, from the interviewee's perspective, say the interviewee, you know, answers the questions and everything goes well, and they say there is eventually a reject. You know, these companies don't give a feedback. If it's a tech round, then it's kind of obvious saying, okay, I was not able to code it, so I'm rejected. But what are the ways that, say, if I need some feedback when I got rejected, that I can get and try to backprop on that feedback, you know, and improve?
You're correct in saying, like, if it's a coding question miss, oftentimes the person, the candidate will know that they didn't solve the coding question at all or in time. I think when it comes to the system design question, if you're a senior engineer or a software engineer, that one may be a little bit more nebulous, right? But I think if you spoke with another person about your performance there, or, you know, like went to my Discord or something like that and asked whether your response was good, you can get a general sense about whether that was it or not. When it comes to the behavioral questions, I think that's really where it might be kind of difficult to understand if there was a big miss there, because a lot of these behavioral questions are about perspective and reflection and whether you are able to sort of effectively pattern match, you know, the question that was asked with the experience that you have. And so I think there, like, our own personal biases will make it very difficult to sort of understand why, you know, whether that was the miss or not. And so if you can sort of think back to it and you're like, I nailed the coding question and I nailed the system design question, well, then, by pigeonhole principle, then it was probably the behavioral questions, right? And so I think that if you use a little bit of deduction, you should be able to review your performance during an interview and get a sense of why you were rejected and whether you were close or not. But I don't think that that's going to be true 100% of the time. There might be situations where you just have no idea why you didn't get an offer extended. What I would say in those situations is if it's not your S-tier company, the company that you were targeting, I wouldn't spend too much time trying to figure out and dissect why you didn't get an offer.
I know we have like a hard stop, so I want to be mindful of your time. For people who want to reach you, like, where can they find you?
Yeah, obviously there's the YouTube channel. So youtube.com/@alifeengineered. I also have a newsletter, so you can sign up for the newsletter. I send a weekly newsletter and at newsletter.alifeengineered.com. You can sign up that way. And from both of those places, you can sign up to my Discord. The Discord is a way to sort of chat. I'm pretty active on it. And so you can find a link there through the about portion of my YouTube channel.
And yeah. Your newsletter is amazing.
I started that last year and I was a bit reticent to start it. And now we're almost at 52 issues. So I'm pretty proud of it.
Mm. After we spoke last time offline, we also started a newsletter.
Yeah.
Hey, you did what I told you to do.
Yes, yeah. Thank you.
How do I subscribe to it?
I will send you the link. We haven't started like writing the newsletter. I just created the website and like have an option for people to sign up. So wonderful. And also I got the Pat Flynn course.
Oh, great.
That you had recommended. So thank you.
Absolutely.
Also one thing before we end, Steve. I mean, towards your passion to help engineers grow in their careers, you have also started to, you know, you have your own course and you're teaching people to do that. Can you talk a little bit about that as well?
Absolutely. You know, I think part of quitting my job and creating a bunch of free content involves subsidizing that free content creation. And so, you know, I decided to create Speedrunter Promotion to help ambitious people get promoted to the next level. And yeah, I think it's a triple win situation where I can get some income from these folks so that I could subsidize my free content creation. I can help them get promoted as quickly as possible. And in big tech, that ends up meaning, you know, $100,000 to $150,000 a year. And I think the third party that wins are the businesses that employ my clients, because internally promoted people are some of the most valuable people within the
100%.
Workforce.
100%.
Totally.
Yeah. Awesome. Yeah. We'll put everything in the description, and thank you so much.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Hey, everyone. Thank you so much for listening to our podcast till now. I hope it added value in your life. And if it did, please subscribe to our channel. It will help us grow and bring more incredible guests. Thank you.